Excellent. So, welcome to the Sunday sermon. continuing on with the talk from yesterday, just because this influences the way we meditate. It's not that meditation is one thing and the Dhamma is another thing, that we learn all these teachings of the Buddha as told in the suttas, and somehow or other we practice a different way when we're meditating. And you see so often in the suttas the Buddha talking about kindness and compassion, and then when we go to meditate, we sometimes practice the opposite. And people, they meditate and then they get annoyed at their friends for making too much noise. And there's something, a disconnect there, something which is quite wrong. Surely, just meditation is a part of the Eightfold Path and should be enhancing our wonderful qualities, you know, especially our precepts. So we go back to what I was saying yesterday about the right view, the first part of the path. I did mention a little bit about, actually quite a lot about anicca and anatta, and of course dukkha is, that is one of those translations which is perfect, just the suffering. Just this world is, you can't squeeze, manipulate out of this world things which it just cannot give you. And it's the nature of this human world, of the many worlds of existence, that you do have a lot of happiness and freedom, but also a lot of suffering as well. And it's a bit of suffering which actually motivates many people on the path to realize, despite all of their best intentions and hard work, still things go wrong. No matter just, you know, what you do in this life, sort of unfortunate things happen. And we have a choice when unfortunate things happen, is to, you know, cry and grieve and stamp up and down and try and blame somebody, which is what people normally do. And instead, the Buddhist path offers us, say, well, what do you expect? We've been telling you this. The old, I told you so when you were born, that your life is suffering. We think, oh, yeah, I know, but I'm wise enough, I'm smart enough. If you live in a good country and you work hard at school and you get your degrees and then you just are smart and you don't waste time in alcohol or drugs and you do the right thing, then you live happily ever after. And unfortunately, even the good people don't always live happily ever after. There's always the problems and difficulties. So what it actually does tell you that we're not here to try and make our prison cell more comfortable, the prison cell of this life. We're here to escape. In other words, that using the simile of your life, this world, being in prison, you were born in prison, grew up in prison, lived all your life in prison. It's called this human body with its five senses. And that sometimes we work very hard and we maybe even get a much bigger prison cell later on because we worked hard to buy one. And we can even get a nice car which goes from one prison cell to another prison wing. We marry a nice other little prisoner somewhere who we fall in love with and have little crims in our which come up. And we do very well, we just businesses, and we sometimes, instead of just doing business to make even more possessions in our little prison cell, then we go off and just try and help other prisoners, you know, the ones less fortunate than us. And all the time we just, all we ever see is five huge walls outside of us. Those five prison walls are sight, hearing, smell, taste and physical touch. Our life is bound by these five senses. And we have a prison guard. And the prison guard is called will. Will is like a nice word because it does mean your intention, your chaitanya, your controller. But it's also like a name, a male name, will. So will the prison guard, do you really think that will is your friend? That if you get to know your prison guard, will, and you can train your prison guard, then you'll have a wonderful time in jail. But you find out that your prison guard lets you down. Your will doesn't always follow the instructions and has not always got your best interests at heart. But nevertheless, every now and again you get some difficulty and suffering. But then you don't realize, of course it's suffering. You're in jail. You're in prison. And one day, you know, that you sometimes hear about, you know, some people have escaped from jail. And the people who have escaped sometimes come back to visit the teachers. And they say, look, it doesn't matter what you do in life, how rich you are, how healthy you are, how smart you are, how many contacts you have in high places, still you're in jail. So, how about escaping? So that's one of the reasons why when people come up to me and they say, oh, you Buddhist monks, you're just escaping from the real world. Yes! You understand. The prison is your world, it's reality, but there's another world which is one much more wonderful. And of course that way of escaping is to actually to, you can't break through those five prison walls. You can't force your way through. But there is a beautiful way through. Is you suppress those walls. It's like you lower them and lower them and lower them and lower them. So that's one of the jobs of once you realize that just trying to make a beautiful world out of a prison cell, no matter how big it is and how many privileges you have, it's still going to be difficult. And to make it even more interesting, that your prison cell, is on death row. In other words, you're all going to die. You're not going to stay there forever. So, in the end, we sort of realize there is a problem. And when things happen to us in life, difficult things happen to us in life, it does become like wake-up call. Just like in the story of the Buddha. You know, haven't you ever seen old people who find it very difficult to even speak and say things and have to be pushed around in a wheelchair? You know, I'm thinking of, you know, poor Ajahn Wayama, you know, in her little hermitage. And have you never seen people really sick and aching and just sometimes even moaning and people who are dying and dead? And you think that that's not going to happen to us. So each one of us. So there is a problem there. And just realizing and accepting that problem is important. But it's not all doom and gloom, because there is an escape. And so you come here on these retreats, you learn a little bit of meditation. And sometimes you can peek over that wall of the five senses. And what's beyond? They're pretty high. But in here, on a retreat, you find that there's nothing much to excite your senses. People don't wear makeup and fancy clothes. We don't go and make this body more exciting than it, well, more depressing, I suppose, than it is. I remember a few times. The one time when one friend, a meditator, sort of, he went to a retreat, he was a guy, and apparently Kate Moss, the supermodel, was on that retreat. And He was very excited, you know, to be able to see one of the most beautiful girls in the world. And as he was got onto the retreat, you know, during the meditation, he opened his eyes and tried to find out which one she was. And he couldn't find her. She was there, but in real life, she looks just like an ordinary person. And later on, he explained that the beauty, which was his fantasy, was just what is added on to this blank canvas of a face called Kate Moss, with makeup, with hair, with lighting and airbrushing, can make her into a someone who is out of this world. And it was the same time when one of those retreats which I gave years ago at the North Perth Redemptorist Monastery, that there was all these young Thai men I'd never seen on a retreat ever before. And I wondered why. And I asked a few Thai disciples, and there was a Thai supermodel, film star or something. She was really famous in Thailand. I don't know who the heck she was. And she was on my meditation retreat. And that's why all these young Thai guys came to learn meditation. But it's not just for guys. I'm sure she wouldn't mind me saying her name, good old Judy Rushforth. She went to Dhammasara to see His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and it took about 3 or 4 days for her name to come up for the interview. So those of you who just put your name down over here, just it's so lovely over here, you can get an interview any old time you like. But she had to wait for 3 or 4 days. And in the meantime, that she was meditating in the morning. She came down to meditate in the morning. And she was sitting quietly, just not really totally into the meditation yet, but just settling down. And somebody came to sit next to her on the next sort of little cushion. And she made a big mistake of turning around to see who it was. And that was the end of her meditation. Richard Gere! Hey, oh, Richard Gere! You know, when he was still young and handsome. I think he's old now, I don't know. Anyway, oh, Richard Gere, no, come on, watch the breath. Breathing in, breathing out, Richard Gere, oh, no. Breathing in, Richard, breathing out, Gere. That's all it was. But anyhow, just when we, sometimes we can get distracted that way, but in the end, that sometimes we learn how to let go of all those things. And as we come here and we meditate, sometimes we do get calm. We get peaceful. And we feel what it's like to have a peaceful mind. So because we're subduing the five senses, and because, you know, there's nothing really exciting in this place, it's why the monks don't have TVs, you know, why we don't listen to music, why we don't sort of do anything which excites the five senses. In fact, they're all pretty subdued. And there comes times in the hall here, you're meditating, and sight, nothing to watch. Hearing, nothing really to hear. Even our chanting, it's not quite the same as rock and roll. Or, I know I've got the name Brahm, but I don't write symphonies or concertos like my namesake. And it's, you know, quite boring. And there's a reason for that. I know that sometimes that, you know, our chanting, we had the Benedictine monks come to visit some years ago, and they asked us, can we listen to your chanting? And I was really embarrassed. I said, well, you know, you guys are professional, you have records, you know, Benedictine Gregorian chanting. That is just amazing stuff. But then I explained that, you know, we do our chanting in particular to be sometimes discordant, not at the same pitch, because we use that to develop dispassion for the world and disgust for sounds. Which is why Everybody knows that if ever you want ghosts to be driven out of your house, you get the Buddhist monks to do the chanting. Because no self-respecting ghost can stand too much of that type of chanting. But anyhow, so everything is like subdued here. So the five senses can become calm and quiet. And then maybe we can actually see what's beyond. The five senses, when they get subdued, it's peace, it's joy. Even sometimes when people have near-death experiences. This is one of those stories, but I love this story. It was the story of the old English lady who had had so many operations. She was obviously very sick, very tired, couldn't do this, couldn't do that because of her illnesses. And on the operating table one day, she died. And this was told, you know, on a BBC interview on near-death experiences. And she died, she went out of her body. So wonderful, letting go of this really heavy, achy, sick, painful, cold, hot body. And that's when she met this person on the other side who said, no, it's not your time, you have to go back. And it was so disappointing. And she said, no, I'm not going back. Going back to that painful, achy, old, wreck, bomb of a body, it's like you've just got a new car and they tell you to go back into your old ramshackle, rattly, hardly works old car. And she said, I'm not going. But you have to. No way. But you must. Make me. And the argument on the astral plane, which was ended somehow when this woman was actually literally pushed back into her body against her will. And when she woke up, come back again, the doctors were just so happy. Ah, you're alive, we've got you back again. And she said, you didn't want to go back. So sometimes if you're very wise, and when you're dying, and the doctor looks in your eyes and says, stay with me, stay with me. If you're very wise, say, no way, not out. I'm out of here. But in her case, she came back and, you know, just describing just how when the five senses disappear, they're subdued. It's very light and very beautiful, very free. Which is one of the reasons why there are times when with your eyes closed, not hearing anything, not smelling, tasting, the body is really relaxed and you can hardly feel it. It's peaceful. It's delightful. It's joyful. Why? What causes it? Because a big problem has been overcome. Some big heap of suffering has been put aside and let go of. Your five senses. These are our playground. We seek delight in sights and sounds, smells and tastes, and physical touch. But then after a while, all those little playgrounds disappear. Now you know some happiness. So this is actually showing us, you know, the five senses of dukkha. My goodness, they are. All of the components of existence, perceiving, feeling, experiencing, will, consciousness, is suffering. Sometimes when I say that in ordinary venues, people say, Ajahn Brahm, you're sick. Get a life. So I already got one and I don't want it. Do you want it? And there's something there which is Dhamma, which sometimes people refuse to accept. But it's right there if you read the teachings. So what does that mean? It means our goal is to subdue these five senses, not to seek for satisfaction and pleasure out there in the latest Harry Potter movie or in the latest experience. That's why sometimes I wonder, what have you got on your bucket list you want to do? Have you seen Niagara Falls yet? Haven't you? Have you seen the Great Wall of China? Have you? Have you seen, what else is, the Great Pyramids in Giza? Have you seen those? Why do you want to see those for? You want to see a waterfall? Serpentine Falls, just around the corner. If you don't want to go and see that, just turn on your shower. It's a waterfall. You want to see Great Wall of China? Go and see just Bodhinyana Wall. That's long enough. That took me a lot of work to pull that thing. What was the other one? The Great Pyramids of Giza. You don't see the Great Pyramids, you see just around the corner here. You see the Great Stupa of Bodhinyana. Sometimes, why do you want to see those things for? Somehow or other, because everybody else has. And you think you're missing out if you haven't seen it. But that's just things of the sight. Oh, where was it? When we did go on a pilgrimage years ago over to India. Part of that pilgrimage, we're going up to Delhi, so we popped by to the Taj Mahal. And I remember just sitting there and thinking, what's beautiful about this? Is it beautiful? Why is it supposed to be a great wonder of the world? And so instead of like everybody else, just thinking, oh, isn't it amazing? Isn't it wonderful? I think maybe that's just because what I've been told to believe. I've been conditioned. This is beauty. And I was sitting there just thinking, what's beautiful about it? It almost ruined all the taxpayers of India at the time. And it was a monument to a indulgent ruler who just lost his wife and hadn't let go of his attachment yet. It was just a monument of attachment. And when I looked at it like this, I just thought of all the money and all the people who died building it. So one of the other people who was on the pilgrimage came and sat next to me, and she said, it's a bit OTT, isn't it? I said, yes, yes, yes. OTT means over the top. And that was true. So sometimes I'm a bit radical when you question what are icons of beauty. But why not question it? And so after a while, over things in the world, now what is beautiful? And of course you all know some of the stories. What I take as beautiful, I must really be sick by the worldly standards, is that story in the second cubicle in the monks, in the lay toilets down there. I'm going to put a plaque in there somewhere. This is the cubicle where Ajahn Mun saw the most beautiful piece of shit he'd ever seen. You all know that story, but that was absolutely true. It wasn't messing around, it was just, wow. So what is beauty? And beauty is what you add on to what you see. It's what you add on to what you hear. It's what you add on to what you smell. You know, two of my most delightful smells, odours which I find really attractive. It's weird, but one is like bat poo, and the other one is like tar, the T-A-R. Because the reason why tar is a very delightful smell to me was because I spent so many years, summers, holidays, weekends, in the local park playing soccer with my friends. And all the metal railings had been taken down during the Second World War, melted for tanks and bombs and shells to get the metal, and replaced by wooden stakes, painted with tar so that they would survive the cold, wet weather. And that smell just stayed with my youth. It was like associated with happy memories of my childhood, playing soccer with my friends. And the same with bat poo. The only reason why that is delightful, because that temple, I said last night, seeing Garudas, and that remote temple, there's a cave in there. And in that cave, I'd spent so many great meditations. It was lots of bats in there. And the smell of the bat is associated with delightful meditation. It's just associations, that's all. So anyway, that's my conditioning, why I like those smells. So if anyone wants to make my little room over there fragrant, collect some fresh bat poo, leave it in there. Forget about lavender or incense. Anyway, so this is the nature of the five senses. What happens when we understand these five senses and we just suppress them? We find we get very still. But how do we do that? If you try and chase them out, they get worse. Which is why from the first of the Eightfold Path, the right view, we learn that in order to suppress, to calm down, to have some peace, to have a peek over the walls of your prison, we find that the right motivation, samma sankappa, many times that was said right thought, and that was just really, no way can that be a correct translation. Because all thought misses the point. Thinking is just a step away from reality. Thinking, and there's so many stories and jokes about thinking. I say jokes because they tell an important truth. If you assume you can get to some truth and wisdom through thought, thought always around things. You think about things, you never see into them. It's like satellites going around the planet, never landing. That's what thinking does. Thinking just gives things a name. We think in names and in ideas, which are old ideas, and we never go deeper. Great thinkers, end up, they can get close, but they can't actually penetrate into stuff. It's the silence when the thinking mind stops. That is where you start to really see stuff. Thinking can get away the silly ideas and put away the delusions and the scams of spirituality. But to go even deeper, you do need to be silent. Thinking is just described as the menu in that simile of the professor going to a five-star restaurant and being given the menu and saying thank you to the waiter and then eating the menu and paying his bill and leaving. He never actually had any food because he didn't know the difference between the food and the words describing the food, the menu. So these are all those little tales which spiritual leaders through ages have been saying, just thinking is okay, but just go deeper. So Eightfold Path, right thought, nah. Even like right intention. And this was where, from my Vinaya. Vinaya is a legal code. And if there's any lawyers here, you know the difference between motivation and intention. Motive is where the act is coming from, its source. And intention is where it's going to. And what you want to achieve, the goal. And at this time in the Eightfold Path, the Sammasankappa is obviously the right motivation. From your correct view and understanding according to the Dhamma, that changes where you're coming from. It's not coming from personal desires or ill will anymore. It's coming from the first of the sankappas, nekama, renunciation. In particular, renouncing the five sense world. This is the first motivation. You're doing this to suppress the five senses, to calm them down, letting go, leaving it alone, so that you can calm down. And avyapada, non-ill will, is a synonym always for compassion and kindness. The only reason I got this, because I was for years thinking, where is kindness and compassion in the Eightfold Path? I couldn't find it anywhere. There's no place we see right compassion. But then you drill down a bit deeper. Ah, there it is, second factor of the second of the Eightfold Path. And the other one was gentleness. And to me, that sort of made so much sense. This is where one is coming from, the preparation, the motivation, before you meditate, to make sure you're not meditating to get something, to attain things. We're meditating to let go. What Ajahn Chah kept on drilling into you, to let go, to disappear, not to own more things and amass more possessions. There was he was a drunkard, was Chogyam Trungpa, but he says some amazing things sometimes, so you'd never judge the person, but if he says something beautiful and meaningful, great. He was a person who coined the term spiritual materialism. Now, having been in the United States, seeing just how materialistic people are, and they are measured by the measured by their achievements in the world. On the Forbes richest 100, and actually, oh okay, here we go, that there's also spiritual materialism. There is a list of the 100 living, inspirational spiritual teachers of the world. And it's put in there by Watkins Bookshop. And I think the last time it was assessed, Pope Francis was number one, and Dalai Lama was number two. And guess who number 70 was? I made it. Not quite the Forbes 100, but it's the Watkins. Top 100 spiritual influential leaders of the world. Anyway, but sometimes people would just, is that the purpose of being in the world for things like that? Of course not. But that's sometimes what people want even to attain spiritually. It's renouncing, letting that sort of stuff go. So when we actually do renounce, and are kind. Kind means nothing in it for us. Beautiful compassion. Open the door of your heart to this moment. And so gentle. Gentle always also means patience. It takes a long time to meditate. To calm down. Sometimes people do this for years and years and years. And in a time when we want instant results, sometimes it's bit frustrating. You wouldn't have it any other way, because it's not what you achieve, it's how much you let go. It takes a while to disengage from all the things that one believes one owns. We tend to amass more things in our houses. To downsize materially is hard enough. To downsize spiritually, how much less you can live with in your spiritual world, not how much more. So, as we do this, you can understand when the motivation is about letting go, not getting, when it's about kindness and gentleness and patience, the next three stages of the Eightfold Path, the right speech, action, livelihood, of course they fall into place. You're coming from the correct place. Letting go, kindness, gentleness and patience. How can you ever shout at somebody or blast them or hit them or be cruel to them or say, come on, come on now. How many times have I told you, blah, 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 blah? How many times have you come to this meditation retreat? Come on, you should be doing something better by now. Of course, it doesn't matter. Patience. It doesn't matter how long it takes. Patience. The nice thing about being a Buddhist, we're never in a rush. If you don't get enlightened this lifetime, you can get enlightened your next lifetime or the lifetime afterwards. What is the rush? Now, when you say that, it does change the attitude. You're much calmer, more peaceful, and that does become the fastest way. Counterintuitive, but it works. When you're rushing, you don't get there. But when you're taking your time, you're already there. So, as we meditate, the precepts are there. And already that's five for the Eightfold Path. Now, after that, number six, the effort. Samavayama. What does that actually mean? Because we mention the word effort and we think, yes, I know how to do that. You were taught that at school. Come on, put effort in. More work, more stuff. And sometimes when you teach kids about right effort, they say, oh no, not again. What is effort? You know that sometimes, even to this day, like doing sort of puzzles, crossword puzzles. And I used to do Sudokus, but they got too easy. Sometimes you like doing things like that. It's not about entertainment, but it's enjoyable. When I was a kid, I loved doing maths. You know, give me some more puzzles to do. That's what it was. Like crossword puzzles or Sudokus, trying to find the answer, find the clue. And so I enjoyed maths. It wasn't work. Didn't need to put any effort in. Just love the stuff. When you enjoy what you're doing, is that really effort? And so even now, teaching, is that any effort? I enjoy this. Meditating, oh, I love meditating, don't put any effort in. I'm not going to spoil it, I'm just going to meditate here and just, oh, this is nice. It's effortless. In the same way, a great painter, the brush does the work. They just sit there or stand there and they just watch it happening. The great musicians, yeah, they've trained, but when it comes time to performing, it just happens. And if anyone who's performing like that, if they start thinking, put even the slightest bit of effort in, it all messes up. Which is one of the reasons why that the effortless meditations are the most beautiful and perfect. You don't force them. They happen. That's why as you have this wonderful right effort, your job is just to renounce, to not be yourself. That's one of those other little sneaky answers which I had to try and make up, because people would ask me, and you ask me, and I've said this before, so it's, I'm not adding anything new. They ask me, Ajahn Brahm, you talk about all of these things like jhanas and other stuff. I remember just once, usually we get away with the excuse that in our Vinaya you're not allowed to tell anybody about your spiritual attainments unless they're other monks or fully ordained nuns. So in Sri Lanka, in one of those really good monasteries, forest monasteries in the south, they had a video camera on me and they asked me, Ajahn Brahm, can you get jhanas? So, they put me on the spot. Even though those cameras, there was only monks there, but those videos would be played to lay people. But then again, I'd have enough of actually not telling, you know, how my meditation really was. So I told you I know all the loopholes. But I said, I'm not going to use any loopholes anymore. I'm going to use Dhamma. So I said on camera, as I've said here before, I said, Ajahn Brahm cannot get into jhanas. Ajahn Brahm, I can't enter jhana. I can't. Oh, we're so disappointed. You wrote all those books about jhanas and you keep talking about jhanas and you can't enter jhana, you hypocrite, you fraud, you hopeless case. And I've been following you for years. I want my money back, all my donations I've given over the, I don't know how many years, I want them back now. And then just having sort of drawn them in, then, you know, the punchline, as it were. It wasn't like a punchline joke, but it was Dhamma. I say, Ajahn Brahm has to disappear first. I have to vanish. Me, as I know me, with my will and doing stuff, that has to disappear. And then jhanas happen. I don't do them. I can't enter them. So then Ajahn Brahm there, forget it. And I did that because that is saying something really important about effort. Where there's an Ajahn Brahm, where there's an I, there's things which you do. The I, part of the thing, it owns things. What you own, you protect, you work, it's yours, it's your business. Let's say, if I go to jhana, if to Bodhinyana Monastery, if I am the abbot, then I'm responsible, I have to do stuff. If I'm a teacher, I have to tell monks off and nuns off and stuff like that. That's what happens if you're a teacher, but it's terrible. You don't want to be a teacher all the time. That's just your job. It's called performance assessment, whatever that means. But when it gets to, you know, the deep meditations, you vanish. You disappear, you don't do it anymore. You don't get in the way, you let the zone just happen. They just sit there and watch. That's all you ever do. Now you know about willpower. And so often. Okay, here we go again, some nice deep stuff. When you get into the part of meditation called nimittas, beautiful lights come in the mind. And it comes a time you develop these nimittas, or they develop. The five senses get further away, more calm, so you can hardly hear anything, and you can't feel your body, and obviously your eyes are closed, and smell, taste just disappeared. And really peaceful, these beautiful lights come into your mind's eye. You know, all this stuff anyway. Sometimes, you know, I'm a bit reticent, I'm just careful not to tell you too many details, because people tend to repeat the details. They make them up. It's not conscious, it's just they want to achieve or do something. And so sometimes they say these things, not because they've experienced them for themselves, it's just they've added that perception onto the experience of nimittas. But I've said this many times, so I don't think I'm going to get into too much difficulty, you know, by saying this, that sometimes the colours you see when you are in nimitta land, they're, if they yellows or golds like the, or browns like I'm seeing in front of on the bamboo floor, they're not just ordinary browns. And the only way that you describe them is more brown than any brown you could see in the world. If it's a blue, it's not a deep blue, it's just an amazing blue. More blue than any blue you'd see with your eyes. And that is such a typical experience of the lights in the jhanas. They're real, but it's more pure. Not like a pastel. You got the pastel, you got the rich colour, and then you keep on going even more rich. And those become the nimittas. Amazing. They're not seen with the eyes, they're seen with the mind. And you get to those beautiful, they're very fascinating. But there was a time when the nimitta was there, beautiful, but it was always moving. Never stable enough to be able to sort of let go totally and have the jhana experience. So why was it moving? And you know that the breakthrough which I had on that particular time was just in my hut shaving. So you saw that actually the image in the mirror, my face, it was moving as I was shaving. And just to prove the point, I held the mirror perfectly still. And still, the image was moving. It wasn't the mind which was a problem. My mind was still. But the one who was watching was not still. So, instead of trying to hold the nimitta still, the one who was watching became still. I never moved. The will stops. When the will stopped, the nimitta was perfectly stable. Then you enter. But when the will disappears, you've gone. The Ajahn Brahm, the Ananda, the Becky, the ping pong, is gone. You're not there. You can't do anything. That's why it is scary at first. Just like using the simile of the prisoner in the jail. When a prisoner has been in jail for such a long time, leaving jail, you got parole, you got day release, your sentence ended, do you want to go? No. You got used to jail. In your jail is your partner, your little small little crims running around, they need you. All of your business, your attachments, all of the all of the things which you've planned to do. Well, just like this one monk said years ago, he was actually an anagarika, and he said, I don't want to ordain yet. He said, why not? I want to wait till the last episode of Harry Potter, because I know when I ordain I can't watch that anymore. Finally got to the last episode, one more to go. No, 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 I'll ordain afterwards. I'm not going to miss out. So, all that rubbish stuff. But anyway, sometimes we let go totally. And then, leaving prison is scary. Are you ready to leave prison? You say, yeah, yeah, okay, yeah, I'm ready, I've done my time. But when you get to the gate, are you ready to walk out? It's tough. But what makes you walk out is so joyful, so blissful. It's like you're on the edge there, scared, because you're having to let go of much of who you think you are. Most of it. Especially the will, the effort. You have to let that go. Can you? Sometimes people say, oh, I can let go of effort, but you're ready to put forth effort, exert your will, whenever it's needed. It's like just the emergency button. If someone's come to take over your mind, or someone's come to harm you, will can protect you. But here, you become so vulnerable. Let go of everything. But there's two things help. One is having a teacher you have known and trusted for a long time, like an Ajahn Chah. You saw him and you just trusted him 100% implicitly. If he said let go, it must be safe. And number two, the sheer joy of it. The bliss. It's like you're on a precipice. And you're afraid to jump. But it's so beautiful, so blissful. It is that joy, the piti sukha, just drags you in. And this is actually why. What is that piti sukha, that joy? The joy of freedom. It is freedom from the five senses. It's because you realize those five senses just are just so difficult to deal with. They're a pain, they're a burden. So when you let them go, whoa, freedom. Just like when people die, freedom from this body. But this is much more profound. So this is actually where you understand what effort really is. You've done the coming from the right place, the motivation, and it's just a letting go effort. Not coming from the sense of self and me, but what you are really letting go of is that controller, the self, the me. It is the controller which creates all this unwholesome stuff inside of you. I want, you're in my way. That doesn't make sense, this makes sense. This person said, I'm going to do it my way. So that's what causes a lot of controlling and ownership. The effort, if it creates ownership, more achievements, more things you protect, more achievements you can put on your shelf. This is my first jhana certificate, like you get at universities. It might be okay for other people, but you know what happened? When I knew enough about Dhamma, even after 7 years as a monk, I went to go and see my mother in London. And I was just trying to get rid of a few of the old stuff and get rid of stuff which I'd kept there. And two of the things which I wanted to get rid of were my university certificates, the BA and MA. Now, you ask, what on earth do you get a Bachelor of Arts for studying theoretical physics? Sure, it should be a BSc. But they do not give out BScs in Cambridge. They're too old. There was always Bachelor of Arts. No matter if you're studying the hardest science you could possibly study. It didn't have BSCs. So anyway, that was just the old. And also at that place, your title as an undergraduate was young gentleman. And if you've seen photographs of me at the time and my behaviour, I really did deserve that young gentleman. Yeah, I was young, but not a gentleman by any stretch of the exam. Okay, just a few little anecdotes. It was an all-male cottage at those times, on the surface. But we used to have our girlfriends in overnight. And as long as the porters are supposed to be guarding the place, look, as long as you don't make any fuss, and you don't, because we're not going to, don't tell, no problem. But then the student committee decided that, our poor girlfriend staying overnight, they couldn't get anything to eat, because it was only for males in the dining area, the refectory in the morning. So cheekily, they put a request to the governing body, this was the student's body, is it okay that women can come in for breakfast? And in true English, Cambridge sort of style, they said, we decline your request on the grounds that gentlemen do not appear their best at that time of the morning. This is so ridiculous. Like, something out of Yes Minister or 40 Towers or something, I don't know. Anyway, it was a good laugh had by all. But anyway, what was I getting into this with? About... B A and M. And so I said, I'm a monk, I don't need this anymore. So I had them there and I tore them up into shreds and put them in the waste bin. And just went off to meditate in my room. My mother never said anything. And then after meditating for an hour or so, I went into the kitchen to try and get myself a cup of tea. And she had all the little pieces on the kitchen table, like a jigsaw puzzle, pasting them all together again. And I felt so bad. I felt so low. That was my mother. And she never said anything, but obviously it wasn't important to me at all. But my goodness, it was important to my mother. And to this day, I thought, stupid. You might know about the Dhamma, but not enough compassion and respect for others. So, anyway, this is as a monk, as a meditator, as a nun, just attainments. That's nothing to do with it. In fact, that's the obstacle. So as one lets go more and more, the right effort becomes how we can renounce. How we can guard the mind from things like gain and loss, fame and notoriety, happiness, suffering, praise and blame, the 8 loka dhammas. We let go of all that stuff. So we let go of that stuff, all to do with the world, all gets us stuck in this samsara, so that when we do right effort, we're restraining the 5 hindrances. And once you've restrained the 5 hindrances, that's a preliminary for the Satipatthana. The Satipatthana begins with Vinaya Loke Abhijja Dhammanasang, which means having abandoned the 5 hindrances, or rather having restrained the 5 hindrances. That is what it means. That is explained in the commentaries. It's got good grounds because loke abhijja, covetousness for the world, what the heck does that mean? That is a synonym. That is the word which means the first hindrance. Dhammanasa is used as a synonym for the second hindrance, vayapada. And in Pali, as it says in the commentaries, in Pali, the first 2 of a group includes the rest of the group. So this is just the idioms of that language at that time. And both commentaries to the Satipatthana, Mahasatipatthana and the Satipatthana Sutta, they both say this. And it's so obvious, you've got to restrain the 5 hindrances before you can do anything and know that what you're actually looking at and mindful of is true. That becomes the preliminary. That is what the other 6 factors of the Eightfold Path have got you. The 5 hindrances. Calm down. So you can actually see what's really there, rather than what you want to see there. And that is what we also do with our meditation practice. No desires, calm them down. No ill will. Why is this breath? I can't watch my breath. Why is it? What a stupid old breath. My mind wandering all over the place. Bang, you stupid mind. You do that one again, and I'm boom, boom, boom. That's not how you meditate with ill will. Calm. Be a friend to your mind. Loving kindness. Be patient. Let go. Okay, mind, whatever you want to do is okay with me. Let it go, and your mind will be very friendly to you. How popular are these retreats? Do I ever shout at you? Do I ever say, you haven't got up early in the morning? It's been so many days I haven't seen you for morning chanting. If you don't come tomorrow morning, blacklisted. That is not how you meditate. You encourage, be a friend. That's why just people come on these retreats, and you're not coming on these retreats just for an easy life. If you want an easy life, you come all the way. I don't know how far you've come for this retreat. Many people come from a long distance to get the time off. You have to beg and grovel, you know, from your boss, whether it's your marital boss or your boss at work. And it's so difficult, but you come here. So this is something which is beautiful here, powerful, profound, the kindness, gentleness, and the fact that this is one of the most powerful ways to get into deep meditation. You sit there kind to your mind. In your mind, just, it plays a game with you. And by plays a game, that's perhaps not the best word. It's easy. Nowhere to go, nothing to do. So you do nothing, you go nowhere, you're here. When you're not doing anything, you become peaceful. So easy. Have I got time? Can we just, I didn't see many sort of people signed up for the interview, so I'm going to do a little 10-minute guided meditation. Just to finish off, a short one. Just to give you some experience of what I mean. If you're late for the kitchen duties, you always blame me. So you're just sitting down. Now we're going to use visualization and imagination. It's only 10 minutes, so you don't need to worry too much about your posture. Sitting down, eyes closed. Imagine you're sitting outside, sitting at the root of a tree, on a grass mat. And the tree is giving this beautiful shade. It's a Ficus rutiliosus, the Bodhi tree. And the ground slopes down to a river. It's a garden, like a park. And the river, this is 2,500 years ago, is flowing, clear, unpolluted. It's the Nirmala River, floating down from the mountains of the Himalaya. And you are the Buddha. Imagine, visualize, like you are role-playing. You're the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree. It's cool, comfortable. You have nothing more to attain. Nothing can be added to your peace, to your liberation, to your wisdom. You know this is your last life. All this, so many births in samsara, this is the end. You're sitting there, really retired from the world. Nothing more to do. Nothing can be added. You can't lose anything. No attachments, no fear. Total freedom. Freedom like you've never experienced before. Freedom with safety, with peace. You don't need to find any more solutions. There are no more questions for you. You're the Buddha under a Bodhi tree. You don't try and improve your meditation or get somewhere where you're not. You are. You've arrived. There's no more traveling, no more journey for you. No more striving. All that is now ended. Whatever there was to achieve, to get, you've done it. like hanging up your boots. You don't need to walk anymore. Hanging up all the efforts, the plans, deleting all your emails and information. You're free. Empty, liberated, out of prison. Nothing missing. Nothing can be added. Just in this moment, enjoying the peace of having nothing to do. Just like a Buddha. And as you get into that role playing, don't doubt or think this is somehow heretical. I've asked you to do it. Imagine you're a Buddha. There is no more will, no more effort required. Your home, safe, free, freedom from bondage or anything needed to be done. Don't have to prove anything. Nothing to gain, nothing to lose. Fame, notoriety. You're just like an empty where people can throw rocks and it goes right through. They can praise, there's nothing can hold it. There's nothing there. You're free. Please excuse me, but now open your eyes. To get a taste of what it must feel like to be a Buddha shows you just how to meditate. Let go. So. Sadhu, sadhu. Okay, anyway, hope that worked. Ooh. Anyway, dear, answer the question about eating meditation. Focus on mind or body, just focus on your food. Otherwise, it'll all fall out and you make a mess. Okay. So I have a few interviews, so see how they go.